In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
A shot on Elo. Good! The Bulls win it!
You know what time it is.
The most amazing, sensational, dramatic.
Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James with the rejection!
Holy cow! Oh my God! I don't believe it! It just continues!
Excellence. Welcome back into another episode of the Sports Hour. This is Mitch Moe.
And this is Dallin. Guys, welcome in. Mitch, hell of an intro there, my friend.
Thanks, well done. Thanks, man.
You feeling ready? I mean, that just seems like you're bringing some good energy to start this pod.
Yeah, I did something I don't usually do before we record, but I was feeling like I need a little pick-me-up. I had me a little sugar-free Red Bull. Just no free ads. No free ads, but...
but you know, we would accept sponsorship.
We would, yeah. Red Bull. I mean, don't be shy. I just needed a little pick-me-up. It's going to be in the short term, because by the time we're done, I'm going to feel like I'm ready to crash. That's what energy drinks do. They're terrible for you. Stay away from drugs and energy drinks, kids. But, I'm ready to go, bro. I'm ready to go.
Yeah,
I'm ready to go.
You're looking and feeling loose. It will be your bedtime by the time we finish. So, yeah, you will be ready to go.
You know, I have the sleeping habits of an old man. Yes, I do.
Well, yeah, I got to work early. It's fine. We get it. You know, but I love the energy you're bringing. You guys can't see this, but Mitch and I had to discuss his choice of hat today. You know, coming into the podcast, he's got the great minor league baseball hats. And so, you know, I actually picked the hat out today. Mitch gave me two options. And we went with the Sacramento River Cats because he's also wearing the A Oakland Athletics shirt. And so obviously the River Cats, you know, longtime AAA affiliate, no longer, because for some reason they just had to mess all that up. But it felt like the right combo, and it looks great on you, my friend.
You made the right choice. The light blue of the Corpus Christi Hooks, which we might have to just bring in next week now that I've revealed what it is. But
yes,
you know,
that was the other option. Yeah.
You know, we'll just have to bring that in. But yeah.
It would have clashed a bit with the green.
Definitely.
Of the A's, I think.
But also, I'm colorblind, so what does it matter to me? It doesn't matter.
That's true. Also, this is a podcast, so you know, no one's seeing it.
No one's seeing it. I could literally wear clown shoes and a big red nose. No one's going to know.
That is true. I don't wear pants when we record.
Neither do I.
I've never done it.
Twinsies.
Wait, you too? I'm just kidding.
Twinsies.
Just kidding, guys. Please don't think about that. All right. So today, Mitch, what we got?
Oh, I wanted to ask you really quick.
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
How's the weather out in Utah?
Oh, it's, you know, it's been a little mixed. To say the least.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we were...
Because out here, we're having that Dallas Cowboys weather peaking in the mid-90s. I'm sorry. We don't have to talk about the weather. I just wanted to say it.
I've seen the TikTok of the weatherman, the sports anchor, right, doing the weather. That is a fantastic line. That is a fantastic...
Yeah.
It's a great one.
I just wanted to say it, and I did. There was no.
You caught me off guard. I was not ready for that. So yeah, well done.
There was no way to smoothly transition to that, so I just had to awkwardly bring up the weather, I guess. So.
Well, it worked because I was very confused. I was like, I don't know why Mitch is asking me what the weather is, but I'm gonna roll with it. And here we.
I'm a weird brain.
Peaky in the mid 90s. That's great. No, that was all timer. That was
classic. But, that's good.
We're gonna talk NBA Finals today. Game 6 taking place tomorrow. We're recording this on June 15th, of the Wednesday. So June 16th, Game 6 of the NBA Finals, with the Warriors having an opportunity to close it out in Boston. We'll see if they can get it done, and we'll talk about this series up until this point. Obviously, we'll get into some news and notes around the world. A number of contract extensions in the NFL that we'll talk about at the top of the show here. And then on the backside, some more fun segments. We'll do a couple more top fives, a couple more forgotten all-stars for you to wrap up the show. So pretty much what we got in store today, right? Right, Mitch Mo?
Yes. Yes. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be what? Top 84. I mean, like, yeah. You can't set the bar too high unless we're feeling really, really good about
right.
it. And this could, I mean, it could be a top 20, but I'm going to say it's top 84. And then it's going to give us plenty of wiggle room in case, you know, it bombs. But
yeah, under promise, over deliver. That's the motto here on the Sports
Hour. That's always the motto.
Yeah. And that's how Mitch and I live our lives. Honestly.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That and if you ain't first, you're last. I mean, those two mantras basically sum up my entire existence.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, if you ain't first, you're last. That goes back to our Ricky Bobby, Cal Naughton Jr.
Yeah,
days.
That's just classic grained in my soul at this point. All right, Mitch, let's start this podcast out because we're going to be first by the end of this thing, damn it. Let's start the way that we always do with the news.
Let's get into the news and notes around the world of sports. Let's get out of the news!
Oh, you know, Linda appreciated that one.
Linda's out of town right now. Actually, oh. I've been taking in packages for her while she's been out of town. So,
what a good.
I think she gets home late tonight, so I'll deliver in the morning. I'll deliver.
There you go.
Afternoon when I get home from work. So,
get you a neighbor like Mitch. Look at that. Incredible.
Yeah, I know. I don't feel so bad yelling because Linda's quite a ways away right now. So, that's okay. She went to Mexico, man.
Wow.
I know.
Can we have her on to ask her about her trip?
I would love to have Linda on. I think she doesn't know what a podcast is, though. So, that's, like.
That's probably fair.
Yeah.
That's probably fair. We need a Sports Hour spinoff that's just Mitch, Mo, and Linda. And you guys just talk about current events or some shit like that.
We, like, reminisce about the 50s, and I have no idea what she's talking about.
You're basically another old person. I love that, actually. Let's kind of workshop that, because I do think there's something there.
There's something.
I definitely do. Mitch, NFL news to start. And as I mentioned, a number of contract extensions that we're going to bring up here. That happened in the last couple weeks since we last recorded. But let's start with the most recent. And this came down today, this morning, on June 15th. And that is Minkah Fitzpatrick, the safety for the Pittsburgh Steelers, getting a big contract extension that will make him the highest paid safety in the NFL. 4-year extension. That's going to average $18.4 million per year. He's got $36 million guaranteed. So it's about 50% guaranteed. Half guaranteed, he's going to get 2 years, $36 million, basically, for sure. I got not many thoughts on this other than Minkah Fitzpatrick is one of the best safeties in the league. And if he's up for an extension and this is the number, then you got to pay it. What else do the Steelers have? And they're not investing into the quarterback position right now, and they're probably not investing in the quarterback position anytime soon, right, with Kenny Pickett. This first round pick. So you have money to spare, and this is where you allocate that money in this sort of situation at top tier players, even if they're maybe less valuable positions. So I'm no problem with the Minkah Fitzpatrick extension. When they did trade for him a couple years ago from Miami, this is what, you know, they paid the first rounder, whatever it was back then. You know, when you give up that kind of draft capital, you're setting yourself up to sign that guy to the big contract and keep him around. And this is what it is. So great player. Well-deserved.
Yeah, no. And you make a great point. They have extra money to spare. They have the 5-year rookie contract with Kenny Pickett. Don't have to invest into a quarterback. You know, you don't have to invest in weapons around him. He has weapons around him. It's all about growth. And Minkah Fitzpatrick is a defensive player you can build around. So, in a kind of aging and kind of with a little, you know, with some small holes here and there on a Steelers defense that's historically been great, it's a good deal that you can lock up a top tier safety for the maybe not the super long term, but at least the foreseeable future on the 4-year deal. So a great deal for Minkah Fitzpatrick becoming the highest paid safety in football history and becoming a Steeler for the next 4 years.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, obviously, Minka Fitzpatrick, TJ Watt, those are the building blocks on that defense for the future. So, of course, you got to lock those guys in. Again, no brainer there. Mitch, another extension that, you know, I guess maybe some would say a surprise, but I thought this was a no-brainer as well. That's Hunter Renfro getting a nice payday from the Las Vegas Raiders. But I think a fair deal here. 2 years, $32 million extension for Hunter Renfro, the wide receiver for the Las Vegas Raiders, who's really come on, especially in this last season, 103 receptions in 2021, which is the second highest in franchise history behind Tim Brown. So whenever you put yourself in that sort of category, probably doing something right. $21 million guaranteed for Hunter Renfro. And I think this is like about right for a guy like Renfro, who didn't come highly touted, wasn't a highly invested draft pick, right? But has emerged to be a very valuable player. So you get him a payday, you get him some nice guaranteed money, but it's not a 4 or 5 year deal. It's not a long-term extension. You're not locked into high guarantees like we see in some of these other wide receiver contracts. It's a fair $16 million a year, $21 million guaranteed. And let's say if you're the Raiders, and let's say Hunter Renfro this year was a fluke. You know, it doesn't look the same with Davante Adams in town. Now there's less targets. He's less impactful. The value's not the same in a couple years. You can move on and you're not committed to paying the guy a lot. So I think this was a pretty fair extension and smart, I think, by the Raiders to keep this guy satisfied and reward him for an excellent season, but not lock yourself into some long-term deal, especially with some moving pieces around him.
Yeah, this was probably... I would say my favorite thing the Raiders did all offseason, even outside of Davante Adams, because what this does is it locks down that slot guy that's going to distract some away from Davante Adams. And I think that this guy could definitely be what Wes Welker was in New England, where, you know, he distracted, he brought attention away from Randy Moss. And now you have to worry about two guys. Hunter Renfro has that skill set and is that guy. You have to pay a guy like that because he brings so much value. You mentioned the 103 receptions last year. This guy is a weapon out of the slot. And I really think that he could be what Wes Welker was in New England opposite Randy Moss, and what, you know, Renfro is going to be opposite of Davante Adams.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, and obviously there is value there. Darren Waller, Davante Adams, Hunter Renfro become this three-headed monster of an offensive attack for the Raiders and for Derek Carr to use. And but I do think, you know, again, we're talking about a fourth round pick in 2019. He's set to play out the final year of his rookie year deal, which is only $2.5 million he's getting this year. So again, it's like he had a great year last year, but is this the real deal? You know, can you block into paying that guy a lot? So I do think this was sort of the right sort of space to get in. And I do think he'll be extremely valuable next to Adams and Waller for the Raiders next season. Mitch, another wide receiver getting a big time extension. This one, I mean, we're talking big time. This is the most guaranteed money a wide receiver has ever gotten in NFL history. That's Cooper Kupp getting a 3 year, $80 million extension with $75 million guaranteed. Again, most guaranteed money ever given to an NFL wide receiver, beating out Tyreek Hill, who $72.2 million that he got in March. Kupp's deal is worth $110 million over the 5 years total of his deal, as this is the 3 year extension on the deal he already had. But he was incredible this last season, right? 145 catches, 1,947 yards, and 16 touchdowns. Super Bowl MVP. Helps them win the Super Bowl this year. I mean, talk about a no-brainer, but it is kind of crazy to think about in the scope of how many talented wide receivers there are in the league right now and how many guys have gotten paid like big money over the last couple months, even that Cooper Kupp is the guy making the most guaranteed out of all of them. Does that surprise you at all to think about? Do you think that's, I don't want to say it's not deserved or don't deserve, or is it deserved or not deserved? Because Cooper Kupp's an amazing player. He deserves as much money as he can get, as does all of these players. But does it surprise you, or do you think it's fair maybe that he is the sort of highest paid in that sense, highest guaranteed?
No, not really. Not when you're coming off being the best wide receiver in football the year prior. I mean, this guy screams like next Steve Largent to me, like one of those all-time great wide receivers, but not just because he's white, but like it's big, you know, that deep threat that he can be. He can run the He can run the underneath stuff. That underneath, that was a really hard word to find for a second there. He can run the underneath stuff. He can line up outside. He can run in the slot. I mean, this guy does a lot of different things. And when you have a wide receiver with that skill set, you want to retain that. And so Cooper, it doesn't surprise me that he's getting this kind of money. I expect the Justin Jeffersons and the Jamar Chases and, you know, guys to get that kind of money moving forward, maybe because they do a lot of those same things just as good as Cooper Kupp does, if not a little bit better at times. So, like, you know, it doesn't surprise me that Cooper Kupp gets this. The Rams have been shelling out money like you wouldn't believe over the last couple of off seasons. And it doesn't surprise me that they make this move for their number one wide receiver in Cooper Kupp, who was on a historic pace last year.
Yeah, no, and I don't pose the question to take anything away from Kupp because – but I do think it's fascinating to sort of think about, again, Tyreek Hill, Davante Adams, Stephon Diggs, like all these guys got extensions within the last couple months, guarantees of $65, $70, $72 million. Cooper Kupp is going to outprice them all at that $75 million mark.
And you know, you're good when your dad's fantasy football league banned him from drafting you.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, you're good when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, again, coming off that last season, he's just the fourth player since the 1970 merger to lead the league in receptions, receiving yards, and receiving touchdowns with his performance in 2021. And so, obviously, well-deserved for him. And as you alluded to, Midge, the Rams are shelling out money, and this came on the heels of another extension that happened earlier in the month, and that was the Aaron Donald extension. After what? I don't want to say threatening, but maybe flirting with retirement, right? Sort of throwing out the idea that I could be done now. You know, I've accomplished a lot, and certainly he had a case there. But Aaron Donald gets an extension from the Rams, who are paying a lot of money, as you mentioned. 2 years, $60 million extension for Aaron Donald. He is a $30 million a year man, and one of just a handful of players in the NFL that can say that, and the only defensive player to say that. So Aaron Donald, obviously on another planet in that sense. If there's any player that deserves that amount of money on defense in the NFL, it's Aaron Donald. Much like the Cooper Kupp thing, you know, much like the Minka Fitzpatrick, you got to pay to keep your guys. You're the best players in the league. You got to pay to keep them. This is the price that it takes. Certainly well-deserved for Aaron Donald. You love to see them posturing retirement, though, to get a little extra cash out of the franchises. Get that billionaire's money when you can. You love to see it. I'm a fan.
Yeah, I mean, well, and look, Aaron Donald, like, he's kind of following the trend of a lot of football players over recent years where they're not playing 13, 14 years. They're playing 8, 9, 10 years and calling it a career. Because they're focusing more on their health and they want to be with their families more and they're all, you know, very, very important things that they're retiring for. But, you know, I think this is the kind of money that would keep keep this type of guy around. You know, it's kind of like, well, no, maybe it's not like that. I was going to make a weird analogy that wasn't going to make any sense. I'm just going to move on from it. But, you know, Aaron Donald definitely deserving of the money. He's the best defensive player in football right now. And, you know, being a $30 million man on the defensive side of the football is not something we've ever seen, I don't think, in NFL history. And it's well deserved for him.
Yeah, I mean, just crazy number to see, but obviously, yeah, I mean, this is the guy that gets it. No brainer here for the Rams, and I mean, as you mentioned, the Matthew Stafford trade and the money that they're putting into him, Cooper Kupp, Jalen Ramsey, Aaron Donald. I mean, this is what it takes to win championships, right? I mean, we'll get to the NBA Finals later, but look at what the Warriors have been willing to do with the luxury tax, paying a lot of guys and keeping a lot of talent around, because when you got a championship window, that is what it takes. And we're seeing the Rams copy that model in the NFL, and it worked in 2021. We'll see if that success continues for him. The last bit of NFL news that I wanted to mention here, because this happened while we were gone, and Ryan Fitzpatrick retires from the NFL, longtime NFL quarterback, 17 seasons. I'm just going to read you this. 17 seasons. He started 147 games, threw 34,990 yards, 223 touchdowns, 169 interceptions. Nice.
You began brightly.
His career as a seventh round pick for the Rams in 2005, and also played for the Cincinnati Bengals, the Buffalo Bills, the Tennessee Titans, Houston Texans, New York Jets, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Miami Dolphins, and Washington Football Team during his career. Incredible. I mean, he played for half the league. This guy, amazing. And he went to Harvard, Mitch. You got to love it.
You burn brightly, Fitzmagic. look, it's it's a sad day when the swaggiest guy in football decides he's gonna hang up the cleats. We were talking about this the other night, and I truly believe this guy will have if not a spot in the booth calling games on Sunday. He will be a quarterback coach in the NFL in the near future. I mean, this guy's a wealth of knowledge, super high football IQ, knows the position inside and out, has gotten the opportunity to play with a bunch of great players, you know, because he played with half the league. It's a bittersweet goodbye, but not a forever goodbye. I think we'll see Ryan Fitzpatrick on the sidelines or in the booth in the very near future.
Yeah, I can't imagine he's going anywhere away from the game. He started games for all 9 NFL teams he played for, and that is an NFL record. No one has ever started that many games for that many different teams.
I don't know if anyone will ever touch that.
Is that like the Stockton assist record, or the, you know, is that on the unbeatable records list? Because that's
gotta be.
I mean, that's pretty incredible to think about.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, I mean,
right.
Never a guy that you wanted to like start willingly, but always was a good guy to fill in. Even if it was like, oh, he threw for 450 yards, but he threw 3 picks, but he threw for 450. Like,
yep.
The guy got it done somehow, some way. It was he was really an incredible player to watch. Never going to be in the Hall of Fame, but, you know, always in our hearts. Always in our hearts.
He's a Hall of Famer to me.
That's right.
Oh, man. Ryan Fitzpatrick, we'll miss you. But congrats on a great NFL career and, you know. Just great stuff. Like you said, we'll see him around, I'm sure. Excited to see what he does next. Mitch, we got a couple more news things before we get to the NBA Finals. You wanted to talk about this happening in MLB. I mean, the odds of this happenstance that occurred, what, just yesterday? Is that right? Or earlier?
Just
this
yesterday.
Is insane. Talk to people through this.
So there is this thing in baseball called the immaculate inning, right? And that is 9 pitches thrown, all of them strikes and 3 strikeouts. That has occurred 106 times in MLB history. It happened twice in the same game on the same 3 hitters yesterday afternoon when the Astros struck out, and I have to get these names right, struck out Nathaniel Lowe, Ezekiel Duran, and Brad Miller of the Texas Rangers on 9 pitches, 9 strikes, twice in one game. Like I said, the 106 times this has happened in MLB history, it happens at a much fewer rate than no-hitters. In fact, there are 316 no-hitters thrown in Major League history to only 106 immaculate innings. So this is an exceptionally rare feat, and it happened twice in the same game with the same 3 hitters, which is an incredible statistic to bring up. I just wanted to give, you know, shed some light on that and how much of an anomaly this is. It, you know, baseball is full of anomalies. We see weird things happen, and baseball's a weird sport in that way, where we see these weird things happen. And I just wanted to shed a little light on that, because that's something I don't know will ever happen again, given the rarity of just one immaculate inning happening.
Yeah, that is insane. It's just an insane thing that happened. Those three guys better be on the bench today. That's all I got to say. They better not be playing today. Like,
and it happened on Dusty Baker's 73rd birthday. So, like, there you go. Happy birthday, Dusty Baker.
Happy birthday, Dusty. Yeah. So who's the Rangers manager? Whoever it is, sit those guys on the bench for today's game. Give them a day off, because that is a tough look. You never want to be on the wrong side of history there. So just take it easy. You know, that's a tough look for them, but incredible. That is just the odds of that happening. And I'm just imagining in my head, Mitch, 106 times over the history of the major leagues, and Major League Baseball has been around for an incredibly long time. So that
like
is
150 years almost.
It basically happens like maybe once a year. You know, it's like maybe once a year we see that. And so for something like that to happen twice in the same game, like to the same players, as you said, nuts. Nuts. We love that kind of stuff here on the Sports Hour. That's the kind of stuff we live for.
The other fun stat I saw was that Vlad Guerrero and Vlad Jr. had the same amount of home runs. I think it was 87 home runs and a .363 on base percentage through the same amount of games at the beginning of their career. 403 games, 87 home runs, .363 on base percentage. And like you said before the show started, this just proves we're living in a simulation.
Yeah, so. Seeing that stat this week on social media, I was like, if this isn't proof we live in a simulation, because that just like they just repeated the code there and input it twice and put him as Junior and was like, we're good. We don't do anything different. That is just
nuts. Wild stuff.
Just nuts. Crazy stuff. Mitch, speaking of nuts, this NBA offseason, I have a feeling it's going to be nuts, and it's certainly going to be it's certainly going to be crazy here in Salt Lake City. And you're already feeling it over the last couple of weeks. Jazz fans here are sort of on edge as to what's coming. The team is unveiling new jerseys on Friday, and there is fear that they're going to be black and yellow and bland. Jazz fans are afraid. And on top of that, the head coach for the last 8 years, the most successful head coach in the Utah Jazz history outside of Jerry Sloan, arguably Quinn Snyder, steps down, resigns as the head coach, not fired. Wasn't anything like that. Wasn't forced out, just resigned after 8 seasons. He said that he felt like the Jazz needed a new voice to take them in a new direction, and he felt like this was the time to do that. He had a 372-264 record in 8 seasons, with the Jazz matching Steve Kerr for the third longest tenure with the team among active head coaches, trailing only Greg Popovich and Eric Spoelstra. And now the Jazz are in much more of a transition, right? I mean, it felt like this offseason could be big for them as far as separating Gobert and Mitchell, what they did there, but Quinn Snyder now also gone. Rumors are swirling around Gobert trade destinations. The reports say that the team will not trade Donovan Mitchell, but is fielding offers for Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert. The Bulls are reportedly interested. The Atlanta Hawks are reportedly interested. Toronto Raptors potentially interested. So very interesting stuff. But it was pretty surprising here in Salt Lake to see Quinn Snyder step down. And it certainly signals a new direction for the team. The list of names, candidates for the head coaching job, Mitch, is 15 names deep.
Mm.
There have been at least 15 names rumored or confirmed to be interviewing for this position, including Terry Stotts, former Blazers head coach, Frank Vogel, former Lakers head coach, and some top assistants around the league, including Will Hardy for the Boston Celtics, Adrian Griffin for the Toronto Raptors, Sam Cassell, the former Milwaukee Buck, as you know, that's how I remember him, is with the Milwaukee Bucks, but played for a number of teams over 15 years. He's an assistant with the Philadelphia 76ers. They're going to interview Jason Terry, played 19 years in the NBA and is a head coach in the G League for the Grand Rapids Gold. They are interviewing like literally everybody that is available. And it makes me very curious as to see what the direction of the Utah Jazz will be. If they're able to swing a trade for Rudy Gobert before the NBA draft, which seems like the intention, so that they could use that first round pick they get in return in this draft to retool. Seems like things can change here very quickly in the next couple of weeks for the Utah Jazz. It just is sort of a waiting game at this point. And as I said, the tension is pretty palpable here among Jazz fans as we wait sort of the next steps for the franchise.
Real quick, you remember Sam Cassell more as a Milwaukee Buck?
Yeah, that is the team that comes to mind when I think of Sam Cassell. I don't know why.
I think of the Minnesota Timberwolves with him and KG.
Okay, I mean, so that's another great one. I mean, he played for, I mean, I'll pull this up again.
Or the
I had
Rockets. He played with the Rockets for a while, but yeah.
He played 15 seasons for the Rockets, Suns, Mavericks, Nets, Bucks, Timberwolves, Clippers, and Celtics. So we talk about Ryan Fitzpatrick getting around the league, Sam Cassell. I mean, that's eight teams right there that he played for. So, yeah, Clippers was the other one.
Right.
Yeah, no, but anywho, so, yeah, interesting to see what will happen with the Jazz. Very interested about these Rudy Gobert trade rumors. And how this will play out, and how the team sort of retools. But interesting offseason going on here. Mitch, final bit of news here before we wrap up the news segment. And that is, I mean, we got to talk about hockey. I know we haven't done the Kraken update in a minute because the season's been over, but the Stanley Cup final begins tonight between the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Colorado Avalanche. So just wanted to mention that Stanley Cup final going on. Will you be trying to watch a little bit of it? Because I'm not going to lie, I didn't watch much of the NHL playoffs, but I will try to tune in to the Stanley Cup as much as I can.
I will be watching a little bit of it. I actually was pulling for the Rangers in that last series. I wanted to see the Rangers get through.
Me too.
But so with that being said, I will be an Avalanche guy.
We're not team three-peat for the Lightning, who have a chance to win their third straight Stanley Cup.
Nah. Give me the Colorado Avalanche, man. Give me the Avalanche. I always like seeing a new guy step in. And I know the Tampa Bay Lightning, they've had quite a few runs over the last about 20 years or so. They've had some quite a bit of success. I want to see the Avalanche get one. Why not?
I'm going to pull for the three-peat. I'll go with the Lightning in the Stanley Cup, and we'll see how this plays out. But it should be a fun series, as you know. We try to do hockey a little more here on the podcast. We got to show some love.
We're slowly incorporating it. It's going to be a process, but
oh man, yeah, it's true. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Mitch. Let's transition from the news and get into the NBA Finals. Game five took place on.
Okay, yeah, well, we can. Sorry.
Are you just trying to confuse me today? Because now I'm just.
We got that Forgotten All-Star coming up. I need to get in your head a little bit.
I was teasing Mitch in our pause, you know, about how tough I made the Forgotten All-Star. Now he's trying to throw me off my game. We're not there yet, Mitch.
No, sorry. Take it away, my friend.
No, you're good. NBA Finals. We're through five games so far. Golden State Warriors lead the series 3-2. And it has been a back-and-forth competitive series. And that's what we expected and what we hoped going into this, right? I picked Boston in seven. Mitch picked Golden State in seven. And we talked about this on the last podcast as we previewed this matchup. So we've got just a couple observations that we've had over the first five games of this series, which, as I mentioned, has gone back and forth. Boston took game one, Golden State game two, Boston game three, Golden State game four. Golden State wins another one in a row by winning game five at home. Game six will happen tomorrow night on June 16th. in Boston. So that's how the series has sort of gone so far. But some of our general observations, Mitch, give me one of your first thoughts on how this series has played out so far.
Look, I'll start with something that I said on the last podcast when talking about Andrew Wiggins. And I had brought this up and I said, you know what? If Andrew Wiggins can handle Luka Doncic, he can handle Jason Tatum. And this guy's defense has been nothing but spectacular against what I feel is their best offensive player, their most well-rounded player. Andrew Wiggins has absolutely been playing lights out. He's been their minutes leader. He's been their workhorse. He's not only been putting up the defense and shutting down anyone he's matched up against, which is for the most part has been Jason Tatum. He's also putting up buckets on the other end. Andrew Wiggins, man, and I know you mentioned this before, and I am 100% on board with you, looks like a finals MVP right now. I mean, this guy is just absolutely playing out of his mind, and he's stepping up when some other guys are lacking behind. We saw in game five there, you know, Steph Curry for the first time in, like, what, 233 games, doesn't make a three-pointer, has an off night, and he steps up and fills the role. Klay Thompson also stepped in with 21, but, you know, Andrew Wiggins has stepped up and filled that role as what Draymond would have been 3-4 years ago, and has stepped in as that defensive piece that can have the offensive output. More so than what Draymond could have ever done, but has stepped up as that offensive help piece and that defensive key that the Warriors have needed to stay in this series with the Celtics and make it competitive.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew Wiggins has been, I think it's safe to say he's been the biggest surprise from any individual player this series, unless you want to count Draymond as a negative surprise, right? And just how bad he's been.
Oh, he's been so bad.
But as far as a positive, I mean, Andrew Wiggins has been the biggest surprise. And, you know, I sort of joked when you said that on the preview podcast, I didn't really pay much mind. I immediately dismissed it. You know, I said Jason Tatum, the Celtics, you know, it's a different beast. It's a different animal. And obviously this is a different series than that Dallas series was. But Andrew Wiggins' individual defense has been top notch. And you look at Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, and Jason Tatum, that main assignment for Andrew Wiggins. But I mean, Tatum's averaging 23 points a game, but he's shooting less than 40% from the field, just 37%. He's not shooting well within the arc when he's getting into the rim because of the defense from Andrew Wiggins and others. And so he has been extremely impactful, and he was a all-star starter, and we all scoffed at that, and we all said Andrew Wiggins whatever. And just think back, I've been thinking about this the last couple of days. Just think back at the trade that they made when they acquired Andrew Wiggins. They traded D'Angelo Russell for Andrew Wiggins and a first that ended up being Jonathan Kuminga. So they ended up with potential finals MVP Andrew Wiggins and like a top five pick that turned into Jonathan Kuminga for D'Angelo Russell, who is a good player, but didn't fit with what they needed. And they have developed Andrew Wiggins into exactly what they needed, which was a defensive stopper, a fluid piece on offense, a defensive individual defender on the wing that they didn't have in Curry, in Klay Thompson, and even in Draymond, because as great as Draymond is, his skill set is more as an undersized defender against bigs, right? Not as a perimeter defender necessarily, but that's what Andrew Wiggins has been able to do. He is averaging 18.4 points a game, 9.4 rebounds, one steal, 1.2 blocks a game in the NBA Finals. He's the second leading scorer on the team, ahead of Klay Thompson, ahead of Jordan Poole and all those others, but obviously behind Steph Curry, and as you said, leading the team in minutes. So Andrew Wiggins has been huge, and when we discussed going into the series, the role players that needed to step up, who was going to step up around the stars on either side, Andrew Wiggins has been the only player to really consistently answer that call on either team throughout the series.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And I expect him to do so in these last two games. No foreshadowing, but No. I expect him to do. I expect him to step up in these, in, you know, these remaining games of the series.
Yeah, and as far as, I mean, the finals MVP, that's, I jest. If the Warriors win and Steph Curry's averaging 30 points a game and they don't give him finals MVP and they give it to Andrew Wiggins, and Steph Curry has never won a finals MVP, lest you forget, because Andre Iguodala stole it in 2015.
Andre Iguodala?
And then KD got the rest of them. So, I mean, the man deserves a finals MVP, and if he got it taken away from him for Andrew Wiggins, I mean, come on, that would be absurd. So I'm not necessarily, I say that in jest, but I do think he deserves highlighting because he has been by far the second best player on that team throughout this NBA Finals.
I tell you what, if I'm voting for the Finals MVP, I'm voting for Andrew Wiggins. I think Steph, averaging over, here's the deal. Here's the deal. I think Steph averaging over 30 is fantastic, right? But you look at Andrew Wiggins' offensive, you know, he's putting out offensively, but defensively, we look at what the Celtics have been able to do, and we'll bring this to the next point, Alan, and I want you to lead the case on this, is we talked about the Warriors' defense counteracting the Celtics' defense, and that's what's going to be the what's going to decide this series. The Warriors' defense has answered the bell. They had the game two game where they gave up 88. They had game four where they gave up 97. Game five where they gave up 94. They have answered the bell, and Andrew Wiggins has been the leader defensively on that team. And we knew that was going to be what was going to determine this series, was the Warriors defense versus the Celtics offense, because we basically said the Warriors offense and the Celtics defense was going to be a wash. If Andrew Wiggins is the leader of that reason that was going to determine that series, then I have to give the vote to Andrew Wiggins.
Oh, Mitch, listen, I appreciate the idea here. I get where you're going, but one, Steph Curry has been excellent on defense in this series in his own right, averaging two steals a game himself. And on top of that, he is literally shouldering, carrying, burdening the entire load of the entire offense, of the entire everything for the Golden State Warriors throughout this series. So to me, I mean, he is the only reason they're even still in this series. It's not already over. The way that Steph carried this team, especially the first three games.
You think that the... I'll let you go. Sorry.
But again, Andrew Wiggins deserves his love. That's all I was trying to do. Give him a little love. Finals MVP, a little rich for me. I get it, but it's fine. Yes, we talked about this in the preview. To me, the key in this series was, again, as you said, the Warriors defense versus the Celtics offense. Who wins this matchup wins the series. And through five games, the Warriors lead 3-2. And it's safe to say that the Warriors defense has won this matchup over the Celtics offense. And as you pointed out, in the three wins that the Warriors have, they have held the Celtics to under 100 points. In the two losses that they have, the Celtics scored 120 and 116 points respectively. So when the Celtics offense is able to get going, they can shoot from outside, they're free moving. They haven't had a problem. The Celtics have been able to roll, and it's been pretty easy. But we've seen more often than not so far in the series, the Celtics struggle on offense, in large part because of what the Warriors are doing as individual defenders, Stephen Curry, Andrew Wiggins, among the others, playing great team defense and really disrupting what is an average offense for the Celtics that has great talent, but not a great system, not a great flow to it. And I think you notice that when you watch this, it doesn't necessarily always feel like they know what's happening. It just kind of seems like we're going to move it, see an opportunity, attack, and hope it works out. You've got so much talent in Tatum and Brown and some of these young players that it works. And I think as they get more experienced in their NBA careers, they'll be able to be more effective in these situations. But we're seeing them struggle more often than not, and that's what's led to the Warriors winning this series so far. So I do think that the numbers are obvious. The Celtics score over 100, they win. When they don't, they lose. So I think that's sort of the benchmark that we're looking at moving forward. And for the Warriors side of this, Mitch, I mean, the Celtics defense, as we mentioned, Celtics defense, Warriors offense, pretty much a wash. It's been about the same in every game, right? 108, 107, 100, 107, 104. They've been right in that range in the, you know, mid 100. They're averaging 105 a game right now, the Golden State Warriors. And if you're the Celtics, you're super happy with that, right? On defense, you're super happy with the Warriors averaging 105 a game. You should be winning this series if you're holding Golden State to 105 points a game. The problem is that their offense hasn't been able to counter what the Warriors are doing on defense. And yeah, as you said, that's why this series is going the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. The Warriors' defense is definitely what's kept them in this series, spearheaded by future MVP Andrew Wiggins. Look, you're right. You're 100% correct. When they score, you know, when you're holding them to an average of 105, you should be happy, because we saw plenty of games this year where the Warriors are putting up 130, 140 sometimes in regulation against teams, like just absolutely decimating teams. And if you're holding them to this, you should be right in that mix of being able to take them the distance. And it's just been I think that the Warriors defense has showed out a little bit more than the Celtics offense has showed out. They need to make adjustments, though. And I think that the Celtics need to find a way to get around this Warriors defense that's been so locked down some of these nights.
Yeah, and let's talk about adjustments, Mitch, because that's one of my biggest observations in this series is, I mean, that it's just been a back and forth series, right? Other than the game four and game five wins by the Warriors, it had been one after the other and trading blows, you know, and sort of feels like a boxing match, right? Round by round. And a big part of that is because each coaching staff has made adjustments after the loss, right? We saw the Warriors get blitzed in the fourth quarter by the Celtics. They shot incredible from deep. Horford, White, all those guys were lights out. And Warriors adjusted. They come back. They smother them in game two. They get the win. Ime Udoka and his staff, they bounce back. They adjust. They get the win in game three. And we've seen sort of coaching adjustments. And I believe Steve Kerr and Ime Udoka deserve a lot of credit for their coaching and the adjustments that they've made throughout this series. We saw more Bielitsa as the series has gone on for the Warriors, which has made an impact, a positive impact for the Warriors on offense coming off the bench. And we've seen some adjustments on the bench personnel for the Celtics as well. I'm particularly impressed, Mitch, with the rookie head coach, Ime Udoka. I mean, this is his first time doing any of this, right? Like as an NBA head coach, let alone your first time in the NBA finals, and to be going toe to toe with one of the greatest coaches of this generation and Steve Kerr and this Warriors team is quite remarkable, and he deserves a lot of credit. But as we enter these final two games, and as now the Celtics have lost two games in a row, it is now time to make those final adjustments and whatever it takes. You need to unlock it here in game six at home to stay alive. And that's going to be the challenge for Ime Udoka and this coaching staff. That's going to be the challenge for the Celtics. What is that adjustment? How can they get more offense? In my opinion, Mitch, I think it's just sort of getting more out of your young stars. It's just getting more out of Tatum and Brown. You need these guys to have a big night. You need somebody to step up and have a big night. They're more than capable of it, but they're still young. They haven't been at this stage. Can they show up and score 40 in the finals? We've never seen it. They've never been there. We don't know, but game six, this is the time to do it. And I think that's what it's going to need to take. And it's going to take one of those guys catching fire and Ime Udoka trusting his young star to carry the team and giving him the ball and giving him the opportunity. I think that's going to be adjustment needed in game six. But these coaches have done a hell of a job. And it's a reason why this series has gone back and forth and why it's been so competitive.
You talk about the offensive adjustments that the Celtics need to make, and I want to talk just briefly about this defensive adjustments I think the Celtics need to make if they want to take this thing seven. We had talked the other night, and I had mentioned that, you know, they had kind of taken away the back cut, the back cut, backside pass stuff that the Warriors have when they run that high screen stuff with Steph Curry, and they've just kind of been letting Steph shoot the ball. Steph has an off night in game five. And partially because they kind of started to figure out how to space out a little bit better and kind of take both away. They need to capitalize on that if they want this thing to go seven. Now, you know, if they can find a way to take away that high ball screen stuff from Steph Curry and defend against the backside back cut stuff where Steph just dumps it down to a guy on the block and he puts it in for two, then you're sitting in a really good position. I think the Celtics team is definitely capable of holding the Warriors under 100 if they're able to do that. And I feel like in game five, we started to see that they were kind of on the cusp of that. They just hadn't quite polished it out. So when we talk about adjustments, I think Coach Yu needs to figure out just how to tighten that up a little bit more and get, like you said, get more out of his young stars offensively, but defensively tighten that up just a little bit more. And I think we're looking at a really competitive game six.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Mitch, because you did notice that in game five. And despite that, despite the fact that Stephen Curry doesn't hit a three in the playoff game, breaking that long streak that he had, and despite the fact that you had a sub performance from him, you still lost the game. And in large part, that's because your offense wasn't efficient enough. But you're seeing it on the defensive end, and surprising that, you know, the Warriors have scored 100 in every single game this series. Even in the losses, they've been able to reach that 100 mark. And I do believe, as you said, if they can hold them to 100, they're going to win that game. And that's got to be the mark. That's got to be the benchmark for the Celtics. We got to keep them under 100 and do enough on offense and continue doing more of what they did in game five. Because you're gonna bet at this point that Andrew Wiggins and Klay Thompson and Jordan Poole and Draymond Green can't beat you. We'll take them versus Steph Curry in these last two games. We'll make them beat us over letting Steph go for 40 a game over these last two games. And we saw that in game five, as you mentioned. And I think we will continue to see this in game six and potentially game seven. And we'll see how the Warriors role players step up, with that pressure. Mitch, the final observation in the finals we wanted to discuss, and then we'll do a little more previewing of the final two games. But it has been surprising to me through five games. This is one of the most competitive finals we've seen in recent years. And there hasn't been a single game that the margin of victory has been single digits. Every single game has been a double digit win. And yet it doesn't feel like it, right? It feels like every game has been so close and so tight, right? We had a 12-point win by the Celtics in game one, 19-point win by the Warriors in game two, 16-point win by the Celtics in game three, 10-point win for the Warriors in game four, and then a 10-point win in game five. And yet, like, this has been such a back-and-forth competitive series. It's never really felt like someone's been blown out, other than maybe that game two 19-point win when the Warriors went up big in that third quarter, and going into that early fourth, they were up almost 20, and that one sort of felt over at that point. But other than that game two, and even in that game one, you know, you had that big turnaround by the Celtics in game four that really flipped it. So that was competitive throughout that last sort of fourth quarter run. But it has felt like a competitive series despite the margins of victories. If you just looked at the box scores, you would assume this maybe hasn't been the most entertaining NBA finals to watch, but I think it hasn't lacked in drama at all. It almost just feels like we're waiting, right, for like it all to sort of break. Like, okay, when's the game winner? When's the buzzer beater by Jaylen Brown in game six to force a game seven? Like, when do we get, like, it's like time to have that now. We haven't had it yet. So I guess that's what I'm sort of waiting for. But this has been a super competitive series, despite not a close finish in any of these games.
Man, if you look at these box scores too, and you look at like points by quarter, and I think this goes back to the coaching that we just talked about, how the adjustments constantly being made. And it seems like they're just trying to win quarter by quarter. And if you line it up right, you're going to end up winning that game. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, this feels like this is just culminating to a awesome game seven. And we're going to finally get that moment. It's like a Broadway show where you're waiting for the final number and you know it's going to be huge and big and dramatic and you're waiting for it and it finally happens. That's what this feels like, is game seven is just going to have its Broadway big number. And it's all culminating and waiting for that. We're just in the crescendo, the buildup, waiting up for game seven. No foreshadowing, but it's been such a good series. Regardless of the scores, I don't care about the scores. It's been a great series.
Yeah. And Mitch, I guess so now begs the question, we both had this series going seven. We've got Golden State up 3-2. Game six is in Boston, but home court hasn't really mattered, right? Both teams have won a road game in the first four games of this series, so both have proven that they can win at home and on the road. So I don't know how much that matters at this point, but we both had the series go in seven games. Is it going seven games?
Oh yeah. This is Boston's swan song. Like, look, I still got the Warriors by the slimmest of margins. Like I said in the previous episode, the slimmest of margins in game seven. And I think that's where the big moment's going to come up. But Boston going back home, this feels like a game where they just figure it all out. And they go back to San Francisco in game seven, and the Warriors figure something else out that's totally going to catch them off guard. I like the Celtics in game six to bring it back to game seven. This is theater and drama in sports at its best. And I like the Celtics in game six. I really do.
Okay. You like the Celtics in game six, but you still are feeling good about the Warriors in seven.
I do. I really think that this is what this is culminating towards, and that the Warriors will find a way to get it done at home in game seven.
Yeah, I do believe this is a seven game series, as I did before the series started. And it hasn't changed even after the two back to back Warriors wins. As you mentioned, with coming back to Boston in game six, I do feel like this young duo of Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum will be energized by this TD Garden crowd at home, and will show up in a big way. At least one of them, if not the pair of them, showing up in a big way to force that game seven. And then game seven in the NBA Finals, it's anyone's game. It's a crapshoot on how that goes. And that's what I always felt like with this Boston team, is that if they could get to that stage, they could be scrappy enough to just get a win the way that we saw Cleveland do in 2016 on the road at Oracle, right? The weird, scrappy game seven game that year, but they just sort of got it done when it mattered. That's the sort of scenario I always felt like was realistic for the Celtics winning the finals. And I still feel confident in Boston in seven. And I do think we're going to be back in San Francisco for game seven.
To quote the great Kevin Millar, a Boston Red Sox, Boston sports native, in support of you, Dallin, we've got Shill game six, or we got Shill game five, we got PD game six, and in game seven, anything can happen. And that's in reference to the 2004 ALCS where they came back from 3-0. And you're right. Anything can happen in game seven. It's the greatest two words in all of sports is game seven. Yep. Because you get the ultimate drama. And I love game sevens. Probably the best feeling as a sports fan is to watch a game seven, right?
Oh, yeah. No, there's nothing better than a game seven. And just the winner go home. It all comes down to this few moments left. I mean, that's just what we want. And, for a great series that we've had in this NBA Finals, that's what we're hoping for, right? Just a couple more great games. And let's just close it off with an awesome game seven in San Francisco to sort of seal off this NBA season.
That's right.
So we'll see how it goes. Very exciting. It's been fun to watch, and we'll continue to monitor and talk about next week as game six will be on Thursday night on the 16th, and then game seven, if necessary, on Sunday the 19th. So next podcast, we will be talking about the NBA Finals winner from this year. So will be fun. So that's going to do it for the NBA Finals, and that'll do it for the first half of this podcast. We're going to take a break and hit a mid-roll. And on the other side, we will do some forgotten all-stars, some top fives, a little fun for you on the back end of the podcast. So stick around, and we'll be right back.
Thanks for checking out the Sports Hour today. We appreciate you wherever you're listening. But if you haven't already, we recommend you check us out and give us a listen on Anchor.
Anchor allows us to provide the best product to you. You can go support the Sports Hour and become a permanent part of the show, like my saint of a mother, Sammy, and my father, David, did.
You can even leave us voice messages with your thoughts and opinions that we can use on the show. Prove to us that you know better than me and Mitchmo.
Moral of the story, people, be more like Sammy and David. Go find us at anchor.fm/thesportshour, guys, and become a part of the conversation. What the hell are you waiting for? Welcome back in to the second half of the Sports Hour with Mitch, Mo, and Dallin. Did a little NBA Finals recap. We got into the news and notes around the world of sports, but now we're going to have a little fun. We're getting into some forgotten all-stars and top fives. And Dallin, we talked in our little pause. Apparently, you have a doozy of a forgotten all-star for me. That's just the word around the grapevine. That's just what I've heard.
Well, I hope so. Every week, I think I have a challenge, and then you guess it on the first try. So who the hell knows at this point? But I've thought back some of the recent names that I've done, and maybe I've been a little too easy on Mitch Moe. Clearly, you're very good at this. So okay. I thought, you know, I'm going to dig a little deeper. I'm going to be a little more challenging this week on my forgotten all-star. So I think I got a good one. I do okay. believe you could get it, and I won't be surprised when you do, because that's what you do, but we'll see okay. if I can stump you. We'll see how it goes. So forgotten all-star this week, Mitch. I thought, since we talked about a number of extensions for some NFL wide receivers, that I'd give you a former NFL wide receiver.
Okay.
So all that's right. what we've got for the forgotten all-star today. Your three hints. First hint here. This player was drafted in 2003
okay.
from Illinois in the fourth round.
Okay.
He had a 12-year career with six different teams.
Okay.
His lone Pro Bowl season was his only season in which he had over 75 receptions and 1,000 yards. In that season, he led the league in receiving yards with 1,448 receiving yards in that individual season, his lone Pro Bowl season.
Wow. His lone Pro Bowl season. How many teams did he play for?
Six different teams.
And how and many after, years?
12 years.
Okay.
After one guess, I'll give you one hint. After another guess, I'll give you another hint. Kind of give you some little direction there.
Oh,
so.
Man. And he was a wide receiver from the 2003 draft class.
Yes, sir.
Hmm. I don't think he went this early. Let's go with... I'm going to go with, I don't think he played for this many teams, but I'm going to guess, Braylon Edwards.
Ooh, that's a good guess. I like that guess. It's not Braylon Edwards.
Okay.
Not Braylon Edwards, but that is a good guess. Okay, I'm going to give you one hint here.
Okay.
After you give me another guess, if you haven't got it right, I'll give you another hint. These will sort of narrow it down for you a bit. But as I mentioned, drafted in 2003, right? 12-year career. He retired in 2015 with the team that drafted him.
Ooh, okay.
So obviously he didn't spend his whole career with that team, but the same team that drafted him, he actually retired with that team.
2003. So. Fourth round pick. That's the one that's throwing me for a loop. It's the fourth round pick. I don't know if he was a fourth round pick, but I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure he was drafted for this team, then went to Denver, then went back to this team at the end of his career. And I think I'm going to go Brandon Lloyd. Are you serious?
I thought I made it hard.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I thought Let's I made go. It hard, and it took you one extra guess this week. Like, that's it. Like, that was hard, right? That was, like, level difficulty hard was that Mitch doesn't get it on the first guess. He gets it on the second one. Amazing stuff. Yes, it's Brandon Lloyd. The wide receiver drafted by the San Francisco 49ers.
Went to the Denver.
The other hint I had was the team he spent the most time with was the Niners. And that would have sort of put the draft thing kind of together and maybe, but his lone Pro Bowl season came in 2010, 77 receptions, 1,448 yards and 11 touchdowns. He led the league in receiving yards that year. And that was the only year he had 1,000 yards. It was the only year he had over 75 receptions. It was the only year he had over 6 touchdowns. He had just been like average other than that, but one huge year in Denver. And there you go. Brandon Lloyd. I can't believe it, man. I really did think I made a hard one. I thought that was good.
Hey, dude. Like, look, it's a curse. It really is a curse. I don't know.
It's incredible. No, you should not be ashamed. You should be celebrated. That's why we do it here. What I want to know is, are the listeners every week like, am I just stupid? Are they along with you? Like, yeah, of course it's this guy.
I don't know. I mean, I would love to think that they're guessing right along with me. But
let us know. Let us know how you guys do on these.
Like that was a hard one. I thought it was okay.
I had to really think about that one.
I really did. But
Well done. Well done, Mitch. Gets another one. I'm going to fail. Let's see how I do.
I think you'll be okay.
Okay.
Last week we had Antoine Jameson. Our last episode we had Antoine Jameson. We're gonna stay in the NBA here. We're gonna stay right in your wheelhouse, the NBA. We're gonna go with this player, who was drafted in the second round, 14th overall in the second round, so 43rd overall, out of Ohio State. He spent all of his time in the NBA with the same team, with the exception of his final year. And whilst being the best left-handed scorer in the league during his time, he was flat out one of the best scorers in the league during his prime. Oh, and I'll give you the year. He was drafted out of Ohio State in 2000.
Okay, so he's a second round pick out of Ohio State. Spent all of his career with the same team except for his final season.
Yes.
Right? What was he? Was he a one-time All-Star? Was he
one-time All-Star, one-time All-NBA?
One time All-Star, one time.
Would you like the year?
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'm trying to just think of Buckeyes off the top of my head that I know. And I'm just going to give a hint that I know is incorrect because he's still playing in the league. But he's the first Buckeye that came to my mind. I'm going to go Mike Conley.
Not Mike Conley. This is a former player.
Right.
Would you like another hint?
Sure.
His nickname was Silky. One of his nicknames.
Silky, huh?
I didn't know this about him either. I didn't know that was one of his nicknames.
Silky.
You might have, but I don't know.
The nickname. Silky.
Because if I give you the other one, it's going to give it away. Like, he had two, and the other one's going to give it away.
Okay. Did you say what position they played? I don't remember.
He was playing that, like, 2-3 spot, shooting guard, small forward. Okay. Yeah.
2000, second round pick, one time All Star. So it's
one time All Star. Yeah. All Star.
I'm gonna go with, and I don't think this is correct either, but I got to give another guess here. I don't think this one. I'm gonna go Mike Bibby. I don't think he played for Ohio State.
No, he didn't. No, that's not it. Okay, so I'm going to give you two hints.
Okay.
I'm going to give you two hints to wind it up. He wore the number 22 his entire career.
Okay.
I'll give you three, actually. I want you to get this one. Wore the number 22 in the Eastern Conference.
Okay.
Except for the last year of his career. And his career was actually cut short by an ACL and MCL injury.
Interesting. Can I ask one more thing? Can you tell me not the team he played his entire career for, but the team he played his last season with? Is that going to give it away?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
He ended with the Phoenix Suns.
With the Suns. Okay. 22. 2-3 guard. 2000 draft. I'm trying to think. You know, I think this guy was a second round pick. That's the part that's been a struggle for me, is trying to think of guys that carved out a long, decent career for themselves as a second round pick, right? It's few and far between.
I honestly thought this guy was a first round pick when I looked him up.
Right. But, and most players you just assume were drafted that high. But I know of a few guys. I'm thinking of one in particular around that era that I believe was a second round pick. And I'm pretty sure his number was 22 or something close to it. So since my first two guesses were awful, I knew my first and second guess weren't even going to be right. I'm going to go here, Mitch. Also, I think you might have given me a confirmation here with my second guess, the way that you reacted. I think I was half right, perhaps, on my first guess. So I'm going to go, and, you know, we talked about this team earlier. We were talking about Sam Cassell and my association with him and a certain team
Just
there.
It.
Is it Michael Redd?
This is Michael Redd, yeah.
Let's go. See, I didn't put together the Ohio State thing, so I wasn't really thinking about it. But second round pick kept coming up, and okay, all right, Michael Redd.
Michael
Redd.
Long time buck, 19 points a game throughout his career. In fact, during the peak of his career, he was a 25, 26 point a game guy. Like, he was one of the best scorers in the league during his prime. Unfortunately, had the devastating knee injury that cut his career short. But this guy was not only one of the great left-handed guys of our generation, but one of the great scorers of this generation, this era. So, Michael Redd. I thought I might have given it away when I laughed at Mike Bibby because I thought you were gonna say Michael Redd, and then I laughed and I went, oh shit, he's not saying Michael Redd.
But yeah, that I'm not gonna lie, that sort of I caught that and I was like, all right, keep that in the back of my mind, Michael. That was maybe close there or something.
But well done, done.
Well, thank you. Done. Listen, I'm not Mitch Moe. Okay, I'm not pulling Brandon Lloyd out on the second guess out of thin air. I need eight hints and all that kind of help in the world, but I'll take it. I will take it. Well done there, Mitch. Let's go into the top fives, and I'll let you go ahead first with your top five this week. Continuing the positional sort of off-season content you've been doing in the top five, right?
Yeah, we're going to stay positional here. We've been doing our top five positional series leading up to the NFL preseason, counting down our top five at each position all time in the NFL. And this week, in this week's edition of Mitch Moe's Top 5 List of the Week, we're going to be doing the top five tight ends of all time. And I'll tell you, Dallin, after looking through all the names and comparing all the numbers and looking at the greatness, the accomplishments of each player, we really have seen the best era of tight ends in NFL history. And I think this is because of the evolution of the position. The tight end of the 1960s and 70s is not the same of the tight end of the 2010s and now. So I think we are really seeing the greatest era of tight ends. And so you're going to see a lot of familiar names on this list. But I want to mention some names that aren't so familiar, maybe. Ozzie Newsome, longtime general manager of the Baltimore Ravens, a former Cleveland Brown. Mike Ditka, you know, shout out to my boy, but he was also a great tight end as a player in his own right for the Chicago Bears, Philadelphia Eagles, and Dallas Cowboys. Jason Witten, a longtime Cowboy, one-time Raider, great tight end. Greg Olsen, Dave Casper, and Kellen Winslow make the list. Kellen Winslow Sr., not Kellen Winslow Jr., by the way.
Kellen not Winslow the one Jr.'s, that's in prison.
Not the one that's in prison. Kellen Winslow Sr. is a fantastic NFL legend.
Speaking of prison, Mitch, where did Aaron Hernandez end up on this list? That's what I need to know.
I left him hanging.
Oh. Listen, he's in the depths of hell right now. Let's be honest. Okay, have you ever watched that Netflix documentary that breaks it down? Because he had, behind every killer is a really fucked up childhood and some family trauma and a lot of stuff. So not to excuse anyone's own personal actions, like murdering people, but he had a pretty crazy life. But that was a fascinating watch if you haven't had a chance.
It was disturbing.
Yeah.
To say the least. Disturbing to say the least. And
but he doesn't make the list, I'm sure.
But he doesn't know. he might have if he didn't kill people. So anyway, we're moving on. And number five on the list, and I think this is probably gonna draw a little bit of controversy, is Travis Kelce. I have Travis Kelce on the list. I know he has a shorter career than a lot of these guys, but he's a 7-time Pro Bowler in his 9 years in the league, or 10 years in the league, a Super Bowl 54 champion, 704 catches, a little over 9,000 yards and 57 touchdowns. Travis Kelce has just been physically dominant since he came into the league. He also developed a lot of great blocking skills. A lot of people know that his brother Jason Kelce is a center for the Philadelphia Eagles, and both of them played offensive line throughout their development of becoming a football player. And Jason Kelce has been also a great blocker outside of the receiving stuff. So Travis Kelce, a dominant weapon for Patrick Mahomes, Alex Smith, the rise of the Kansas City Chiefs over the last half decade. I think he makes the list, and I think that this is one of those guys that time will only tell. He probably will wind up higher on this list as his career progresses.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with you with what he's done so far in his career, no doubt.
Yeah, 100%. Number four on this list is one of my favorite football personalities of all time, Shannon Sharp. Shannon Sharp gets on.
He is the best. Say what you want about that show. Say what you want about Skip Bayless. Shannon Sharp is incredible content.
He is the best. He keeps that ship afloat.
It's incredible.
The longtime Denver Bronco, the two-time Baltimore Raven, four-time first-team All-Pro, 8-time Pro Bowler, 3-time Super Bowl champion, 2 with the Broncos, 1 with the Ravens, 815 catches, a little over 10,000 yards and 62 touchdowns, Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2011. It's a tragedy because we could have had two all-time great tight ends that were brothers. If Sterling Sharp had not had the devastating injury with the Green Bay Packers, we would have had two brothers on this list. Shannon was the one that stayed healthy and put together an absolutely fantastic career. He made Trent Dilfer look like a quarterback god in 2000 when the Ravens made that run for their Super Bowl. He was a very consistent weapon for John Elway in that Broncos offense. So Shannon Sharp with the winning and the numbers has to make this list number four.
Yeah, no argument there. I am envisioning in my head the final three. I think I know the names. I'm just very curious to see the order.
Yes, and I think you and I are on the same page as far as this goes. Number three is going to be Rob Gronkowski.
A
longtime New England Patriot, now a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. Maybe he might be coming back. We don't know yet. But a 4-time first team All Pro, 5-time Pro Bowler, a 4-time Super Bowl champion, a comeback player of the year in 2014, 621 catches, 9,286 yards, and 92 touchdowns. And look, the yardage is not going to compare to the other two above the list, but the dominance at his position during his time period is what sets it. I mean, the winning obviously helps, but the dominance at his position physically during his time period is what sets him apart for the rest of the pack. This guy was just a man among boys, with his 6'8 frame, 250 pound frame, just reaching over guys, and being a dominant red zone force. He has to be on this list. He's also a he's also on the NFL all-time 100 team, as a guy that only played 9 years leading up to that selection. So if you want to point to any sort of greatness or what kind of production he's had leading up to that, Rob Gronkowski fits that bill. This guy was just absolutely fantastic throughout his career, whether it's over or not.
Yeah, and I do think your point there is exactly how I feel. There hasn't been a tight end in the history of the NFL who was as dominant during his prime as Rob Gronkowski. And that's right. Why he deserves to be on these all-time lists and why he deserves to be mentioned among the greats, because no one's been as dominant as he was when he was in that stretch. And he was unstoppable. He was arguably the best offensive weapon in the league as a tight end, and there haven't been many of those. So absolutely, short career side, you know, the stats might not look the same, but yeah, Gronkowski's up there. Top three for sure. I think three is, I agree with you there.
Yeah, and number two, of course, it's between two names. It's between two names, and I think that you can make a case for either one to be number one, but I'm going to go Antonio Gates at number two.
I'm with you. I'm with you here.
A 16-year career, three-time All-Pro, eight-time Pro Bowler, 955 catches, almost 1,200 yards receiving, and 116 touchdowns. This guy wasn't even a football player. He was a basketball player that was drafted for his rare athletic ability to just create problems wherever he was on the football field. This guy was a matchup nightmare. And what gives him the edge over a Rob Gronkowski is not only was he dominant during his prime, but he had longevity and it carried. And even in his later years, it was still a guy you worried about.
Yeah.
And Antonio Gates, man, I wish he was playing in his prime right now with a Justin Herbert, because that would be a dangerous combination. A dangerous combination to see at a prime Antonio Gates with Justin Herbert would be just devastating. Antonio Gates, the basketball player by trade turned football legend, becomes number two on the list.
Yeah, I'm with you here at Gates on number two. And I just think, I mean, he's just a predecessor for a lot of the prospects that we see in the NFL today, right? Just freak athlete. And you take a bet on the athleticism and the traits, and we could teach him how to play football and we could teach him to do certain things, and he will dominate physically in that realm. And that's exactly what Antonio Gates was able to do. So, I mean, shout out to him, but also shout out to the Chargers for taking the shot, for developing him into that player. Incredible story for him, as you mentioned, not be thought of a football player. And he is, you know, arguably the greatest tight end of all time.
You know what? And this really started a trend, and you're absolutely right when you make this point. It started a trend of looking for athleticism in the tight end position, because number one goes to Tony Gonzalez, who once again was another former college basketball player. Played for, was that 11 seasons in Kansas City, another five in Atlanta. A six-time All-Pro, 14-time Pro Bowler, over 1,300 catches, just a little over 15,000 yards receiving and 111 touchdowns. Pro Football Hall of Famer 2019, part of the All-100 team in 2019. You could say he pioneered the trend of basketball players being drafted as tight ends, but you know what? It really just, as a whole, started to go, hey, the tight end is a weapon we could use it's not just another lineman. We can yep. use him as a receiving threat. And Tony Gonzalez definitely may not have been the original pioneer for it. We saw it a lot, like in names that I mentioned before, with Kellen Winslow and Dave Casper of, the, mm-hmm. of those 70s Raiders teams. You know, we've seen it before, but we don't have to rely on him solely as a blocker. So Tony Gonzalez just happened to be the best to ever do it in that dual role position. So Tony Gonzalez, the greatest tight end of all time. For those that want to say that it's Gronk, maybe time will tell. We talked about it that, you know, these positions age a little bit better over time, but I think it's going to be hard to surpass Tony Gonzalez as the greatest tight end of all time.
Yeah, I mean, those numbers are just insane. And I mean, you talk about the tight end position, and I mean, Gonzalez and Gates and some of these guys, you know, Shannon Sharp, were sort of the first to sort of make the tight end a useful mismatch, right? And that's mm-hmm. how we see it today, is a mismatch. You're going to put a cornerback out here. You're going to put a slow linebacker. We're going to get an athletic tight end. We're going to get a guy that's 5 inches bigger than your corner. Have fun guarding him, right? It's become a huge mismatch and a huge offensive weapon. Some of the best pass catchers in the league today are tight ends. And yeah, I think you could look back at some of these guys, and most notably at the top there, Tony Gonzalez, for what he was able to do with those Chiefs offense. And for so many years, 16 seasons, he was effective in so many different eras as the league evolved and grew, his passing offenses evolved and grew. And I think that, you know, he deserves credit for that as well. So well done, Mitch. Great top five. Run through five through one more time.
Yeah, so number five on the list is Travis Kelce. Number four, Shannon Sharp. Number three, Gronk, Rob Gronkowski. Number two, Antonio Gates. And number one, Tony Gonzalez.
Okay. You love to see it. Well done, Mitch. Great, great list. And again, I'm right there with you. I thought, like I said, the final three, I thought I could see where it was going. It was Gronk, Gonzalez, Gates. I was curious to see what order you put them in, but I'm right there with you on the order. I think that's fair. Good. Is you put Kelce at five, and I know you mentioned some of the honorable mentions. Who was there any debate there? Was the five pretty solid to come up with, or was there somebody you thought of throwing in there at number six?
No, I really wanted to throw either Ozzie Newsome or Kellen Winslow in there.
Okay,
I really did. I just think Travis Kelce, again, dominance in the era, and yeah. I mean, he's just clearly been the best tight end after the, you know, post-Gronk dominance. It's been Travis Kelce. Gronk, you know, struggled with the injuries there for the last back, you know, his last years at New England, and Kelce was the guy. So I think that if I were to make this list again, I would probably throw Winslow in over Kelce, but Kelce, you know, also shows a lot of upside, and I think he could be higher on this list when it's all said and done. So.
Yeah, no doubt. No, I do like the Kelce pick at five, and I do think they're deserve some credit with the way the tight end position is used now and how much more valuable it is now. Probably makes a better case for him over some of the other tight ends. But a great list as always, Mitch. We'll continue to look forward to more of the positional rankings throughout this offseason and whatever comes next. We had some linebackers, right, the week before. We've had tight ends now. We'll keep them coming, huh?
That's right. That's right. I think we'll be looking at wide receivers next week. So.
Ooh, okay. Well, I could tell you who's going to be number one.
Maybe.
Well, if it's not Jerry Rice, I'm striking. All right, that's all I'm saying.
Shut up! Spoil the list!
Spoiler alert. All right, Mitch, I've got a top five for you to wrap up the podcast here. Today what I'm gonna do, we're gonna look ahead at the NBA draft, the 2022 NBA draft coming up on June 23rd, so a week from Thursday, next week. On today's edition of Mitch Moe's Top five list of the week,
presented by Dallin.
I'm going to be giving you my five favorite players in the NBA draft, my five favorite prospects in this sort of NBA draft class. And it's going to be a mix of some players at the top of the board, some maybe down in the mid first round, maybe the lottery range, maybe a little further. And these aren't my five best players or the way that I would rank them, just five of my favorite players in this year's NBA draft for one reason or another. And I'm going to start at the top, Mitch, with who I've come around on as my number one prospect, my favorite prospect in this year's NBA draft. And that is Paolo Banchero, the big man, the forward out of Duke. Paolo is everything you want in a modern star in a positionless NBA. 6'10", 250, averaged 17 points a game, 7 rebounds, 3 assists last year at Duke. Great off the cut, attacking the rim. Shot 32% outside. Not great, but he obviously shows some flashes there. Great ball handler. And really a good passer. And I think that's what makes Banchero so alluring to me, is that size and playmaking ability. And we've seen in the NBA, in the modern NBA, how valuable a big playmaker can be. We see it in LeBron. You see it in KD. You see it in Giannis. Think about Nikola Jokic in a very different way, how effective he is as a big man and a primary playmaker on that offense. And I look at Banchero, and if he can become the offensive threat, the true shooting threat on the outside, as well as really honing in as a passer, he could be that level of star. And that's sort of the that's what I see in Banchero. I think at the very least, he's an extremely effective wing player. I see a prospect very similar to like Michael Porter Jr. when he was coming out a couple years ago. Now, he had the injury that forced him to fall all the way to 13 or 14 with the Nuggets. But going into that college basketball season, he was the number one prospect out of Missouri. He would have been the number one pick had he been healthy. And he's same, similar size, similar sort of skill set that we see in Paolo Banchero. And again, I believe in Banchero as the guy that probably has the highest upside for star potential in this NBA draft, probably makes him more worthy of the number one overall pick, depending on what you're looking for the Orlando Magic, who do sit at number one. But my number one prospect, the guy I think who has the highest star power capability, and the guy I would take number one overall if I was at the top, that's Paolo Banchero, the big man out of Duke.
You mentioned Michael Porter Jr., and I agree with that. But this sounds like, to me, it sounds like Zion Williamson without the hype. Like, it sounds like Zion without the mega hype, the big body guy, great slasher, maybe not a great perimeter shooter. And you're hoping that he improves on that part of his game to become a truly dominant NBA force. So I love the pick. I love Paolo Banchero, and I love him in your number one spot. It's interesting to go from the one to the five. To me, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no other way to present this list, though.
We just got to start at the top. And again, he was my number one guy, so I had to bring him up here. Another guy I'm very high on, and you've heard me talk about him here on this podcast, and we'll go a little more in depth here, is Chet Holmgren, another one of my favorite players in this NBA draft. And the biggest, highest risk, highest reward player in this entire draft me is Chet Holmgren, the big man out of Gonzaga, 7 foot, 195 pounds, lanky figure. And that is the fear around him. Can he withstand the strength of grown men in the NBA? Can he compete? Can he avoid injury? Right? That's going to be the questions around Chet Holmgren. But what he can do is he's a shot blocker with guard-like skills. He has the ability to pass. As a big man, he can shoot from outside, shot 41% from three at Gonzaga this past year. Also had 3.6 blocks a game and 9.6 rebounds a game with 14 points, shooting 70% true shooting percentage from the field. You look at him in person, and I got to see him play BYU this year in Provo, and you don't look at that guy and think he can dribble the ball. Like, you think of Sean Bradley, right? And if Sean Bradley is 7'6", we're going to try to dribble the ball. It just wasn't going to work. You're like, please don't do that. But Chet is leading fast breaks leading fast breaks at 7 foot with incredible ball skills and great vision and a great passer. And you saw glimpses of it in Gonzaga. I think some of the issues with people projecting forward is maybe you didn't see as much as you wanted out of that 1 year in college. Coming out of Minnesota in high school, he was the number one prospect. He was highly touted, and you would have maybe wanted to see more of the outside game, more of the playmaking, but I believe it's there. The glimpses that we saw are real. He had no problem battling in the post, no matter who was thrown at him, no matter different body types, big, size, strong, skinny, whatever it was, he had no problem. And I know his college, and I know they play in the WCC. He wasn't playing the Big 12. He wasn't playing against top, top talent. But he can hold his own. I don't worry about him in the NBA as far as that goes. It's ultimately about can he reach his ceiling? And his ceiling is a generational type prospect, a Rudy Gobert type defender who can also shoot the perimeter and can also facilitate. I mean, that's a superstar, right? I mean, that is a superstar level player we're talking about if it all hits. And that's why Chet Holmgren is so fascinating to me. And that's why he's one of my favorite players in this draft.
It's so funny. Chet Holmgren has a very wide range of possibilities for me. Yeah. Physicality wise, Sean Bradley, and you named the name, and I was pointing at you while you said it, because I was like, that's the first name that came to mind. Sean Bradley at its peak, Dirk Nowitzki, big man that can shoot the ball and can handle the ball well, which is something that he's shown that he can do at Gonzaga. So, you know, the frame worries me like Sean Bradley, but the skill set gives me hope like Dirk. So I think that there's a wide range of possibilities that could happen with Chet Holmgren, and that's what makes him so exciting. It's so exciting to see what this guy's going to pan out to be.
Yeah, no doubt. And I do think like fit is going to be huge. Having a coaching staff that's going to work with him, develop him, utilize his skill sets in the best way, like fit is going to be huge for this kid. But if he finds the right fit, and if an organization is willing to give him some time and utilize what he does well, I really think he can become a really special player in the NBA. The next player, Mitch, is a guy who's sort of right around the top five range, depending on who you talk to. And that's Keegan Murray, the forward out of Iowa, a guy I really like in this NBA draft. And I would say this is the guy that I think probably isn't being talked about enough that has the chance to be the best player in this draft. I think when it's all said and done, Keegan Murray could be the best player in this whole draft. And he's sort of an under the radar rising star in this past year of college basketball. This past season, 23.3 points per game for the Hawkeyes, 38% from three, 8 rebounds, 2 blocks. He was unranked in high school, just a late bloomer kind of guy. But has all the sort of wing measurables and skill set that you want to see. 6'8", 215, versatile on-ball defender. He can handle the wings. He can handle the bigs, maybe even small ball center potentially. Does everything sort of really well, but just doesn't have a lot of good tape, doesn't have the promises as some other guys. He's 22 years old. Again, as I said, a late bloomer, sort of developing late, and you do wonder, right? Is he just a grown man against college kids looking good? Or is this a turning point in his career that's really showing you what he can become? But I think he's going to be a good scorer at the next level, a solid wing defender, and that's going to be a really valuable player. And in the right system, that's the kind of guy that can take off and really big time. I'm pretty high on Keegan Murray. I do think like sneaking in the top 3-4, I wouldn't hate it. I really wouldn't hate it, depending on the team and what you need out of this draft. But Keegan Murray, I'm very high on. Again, a forward out of Iowa, but the ringer's Kevin O'Connor has him as the 6th top ranked prospect. ESPN has him at number 5, so that's kind of the range he's at. But there you go, that's my next player, Keegan Murray.
I mean, a true college prospect, a true guy that's been there four years. Yep. Years as a 22 year old, a guy that's really had his chance to groom himself. Yeah, I love it. I mean, that just screams guy that's ready to jump into the NBA level and be a contributor right off the bat. So love it. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. And you say that, Mitch, and that's actually the description I had for the next player on my favorite players. Is a guy, a winning player from day one, is what I put down about this, which is what you just described, Keegan Murray. But I'm I'm going to also put that as a description for Benedict Mathurin, the guard out of Arizona, who's another one of my favorite players in this draft. And I believe Benedict Mathurin is the type of guy that a team is going to get. He's going to come in and be a winning player on day one. 6'4.5", 6'5", 205 pounds out of Arizona. Knockdown shooter, shot making ability off the dribble. He's going to have to develop on the defensive side of the ball. It's something he struggled with in Arizona. Could improve as a facilitator. But this is a wing player who can put up buckets. 17 points a game last season for Arizona, shot just under 38% from three. Mathurin was a guy who was the Pac-12 player of the year. Made a big leap this sophomore season. He's got the type of frame, 6'6", wing sort of player that NBA teams are going to like. But I think this guy could just put up buckets. And I like some of the comps that Kevin O'Connor has for him in the NBA Ringer draft guide. Caris LeVert, prime Victor Oladipo. Those are sort of the players I see, right? Tough players, mentally tough, smart guys, great offensive. Can he get a little bit more out of him on the defensive side? That's what I think. And in the modern NBA, you need wing guys that can shoot but also defend, and he'll certainly need to develop that. But if he can, he could be really good. But I do think day one, he comes in and he's a contributor on a solid team, and he's making that rotation.
Love your breakdown of that player. Hate his name because, 1776. We don't like guys
never forget.
We don't like guys named Benedict. So, but otherwise, yeah, I love the player. Never seen him play, but I love your pick, and I trust your analysis there.
Yeah, Benedict Mathurin. Go watch some of the games from the NCAA tournament this past year with Arizona. He was their best player, and it just brings an intensity and a tenacity that I really enjoyed. Relentless playing the ball, and I do think he'll be well at the next level. But the last name, Mitch, on my favorite players is a little farther down. All these guys have been top 10. This player, ranked 18th by Kevin O'Connor in the Ringer, ranked 21 by ESPN. This is Jalen Williams, the forward out of Santa Clara, a WCC player, and a late riser in this draft prospect. In fact, just another late bloomer in general, 21 years old, out of Santa Clara. This was a guy who took a sort of unconventional approach here to this NBA draft process. Made a strong impression at his workouts this past offseason that really sort of solidified his case, but broke out in the WCC, 6'6", 7-foot wingspan. He has that NBA frame and what you're looking for on that end. Averaged 18 points a game, shot just under 40% from three in the WCC this year for Santa Clara. 44% on catch and shoot threes. Looking really good this year as a junior, and really made that leap. But this was a guy, Mitch, what Phoenix junior high school, not even 5'11 going into his senior year. Really didn't get many offers. Got to 6'3", ended up at Santa Clara, and has really just continued to grow. Shot up to 6'5" by his freshman year, and all of a sudden he's a guard playing at this higher size, and now he's a wing player with a guard skill set that can also defend with that long wingspan and hit the outside shot. And Jalen Williams is the type of prospect that NBA teams are going to see and say, if we can get him in our system, and you start thinking Mikal Bridges, and you start thinking, all these prototypical wing defenders that we see nowadays, all those guys on the Phoenix Suns, right? All the Torrey Craigs and all those guys with that length, with that size, and how effective they can be, and what this kid did in college at a low level in the WCC, not the best competition, but he's got the measurables and he made a big improvement this year. So I 21, right? 21 at the Ringer, 18 at the Ringer, 21 ESPN. I do think he goes top 20. I do think NBA teams are going to bet on his measurables and his upside, and a name to certainly watch. More of a developmental, again, he is 21. He's not a 19-year-old, but with the level of competition and his sort of path to the NBA, may take some time, but I think teams are going to bet on those measurables and be very high on him. And a guy I saw beat BYU at the buzzer this year, Santa Clara upsetting BYU earlier, I think it was January, 26 points in that game, hit a buzzer beater to win it. Just a great player, a really solid player, and I think he's going to be good at the next level.
think I remember you mentioning his name earlier in the year when you were talking about that upset. So, yeah, like you said, great wing guy with guard skill sets. Glad you mentioned him. Dallin, why don't you give us your rundown of your top five guys to keep your eye on going into the NBA draft?
Yeah, my favorite players in this year's draft, Paolo Banchero, the forward out of Duke, my number one player in this year's draft. Chet Holmgren, the big man out of Gonzaga, the highest risk, highest reward player available this year. Keegan Murray, the forward out of Iowa, my player to bet on to be the best player in this draft outside of those top three guys. Benedict Mathurin, the guard out of Arizona, winning player from day one. And Jalen Williams, the forward from Santa Clara, a late bloomer, got the measurables, going to be a talent bet for NBA teams. So that's my favorite players this year's NBA draft. Again, the NBA draft coming up June 23rd. So we'll talk about that as that happens and react to sort of how that plays out. I'm very intrigued to see who goes number one, Mitch. The rumors and the reports have shown more and more Jabari Smith at number one out of Auburn. And I really like Jabari Smith. I think he's a great fit for Orlando. But then after that, it's going to get really interesting. So I'm very excited to see how this NBA draft plays out.
Oh, yeah. Going to be very interesting. There's a lot of big names at the top. But, obviously the big one, is he going to stay at number one? Is he going to fall to number two? Is someone else going to sneak into that number one slot? Definitely going to be interesting as we get close to that July or that June 23rd date.
No doubt. All right, Mitch, that's it for the top five. And that's going to do it for the podcast. It has been a pleasure being here with you guys, hanging out, having a good time. If you don't already, follow the socials. The Twitter is at the Sports Hour Guys, Instagram at the Sports Hour Guys, the TikTok at the Sports Hour Guys. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lil Thoint. Check out the website if you haven't already, thesportshourguys.wordpress.com. You can check out our latest content on there. Mitch, remind the people about Anchor.
Anchor is the only way that you can become a part of the conversation. If you have a question for me and Dallin, and you want it answered live here on the show, you can go ahead and leave us a voice message. We will answer that message live here on the show. You'll become a permanent part of the conversation. Go ahead and check out anchor.fm/sportshour guys. You can go listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcast. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to it. Go on Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating review. Tell us that we suck, because Dallin, that is the only way that we can get better.
That is the only way that we could get better. Guys, if you are equally as good at Mitch and the Forgotten All-Stars, if you're way worse than him and you're more like me, like, leave us a voice message. Let us know. I'd love to know. Do you guys, are you crushing these like Mitch Mo? Are you struggling like me through these?
I'll tell you what. I will offer a challenge right now to any listener. We will get them on the show to do 1v1. Forgotten All-Star.
I love it. If you, yes. Let's see it. Let's see if you guys can come up with a good Forgotten All-Star for us. I like that, Mitch.
Yes, I love it.
I like that.
Bring it okay. on. I'm feeling good. Yes. I'm feeling good after Brandon Lloyd.
Oh,
bring
my, it on. I mean, let's you go. Should. Jeez, that was freaking ridiculous. I still can't believe that. Incredible. I love it. Yes. Come be a part of the show, guys, because that's why we do it. We do it because Mitch and I love to sit here talk about sports, but we also want you to be a part of the conversation if you want to. So you're more than welcome. We'd love to hear from you. So check us out on Anchor. Leave us the rating and the review, as Mitch said, because we need to know if we suck. Well, we do know we suck. We need to be reminded of it, right?
That's right. Yeah. No, just there tell us go. That we suck again. As we keep,
over and over again.
We know that we do. Just tell us over and over and over again.
You look handsome as always, my friend. It's good to see your beautiful face.
You too, pal. You too.
Thanks, man. Growing out the beard a little bit, just a little bit, It's subtle. I can't do much.
I'm going for the Sam Elliott look. So, we're
you saw Top Gun and you're like, I got to grow out the stash.
I wanted to make a very clear point. I started doing this before Top Gun came out, okay?
This ain't Miles Teller cosplay. This was a Mitch Mo original.
Did this well before Top Gun.
For the record, let it be known. I love it.
It's right. Well, I want it good. On the record.
There you go. Thanks. Looks good. Well, guys, again, thanks for sticking around. We love you. We appreciate you. And we will catch you next week.
Welcome home, Parker Brooks. See ya.